Welcome to the latest episode of the Conferences for Women podcast, offering true stories and real-world advice from the sharpest, most successful women out there. I'm your host, Lisa Bennett, and today I have a question for you. I'll be frank. It's a personal, somewhat prying question. Are you ready? Here it is. Have you reached your potential yet? Or do you feel there might be something holding you back? For many of us, certainly, I'll admit for me, there's sometimes an uncomfortable gap between how we present ourselves and what deep down we know ourselves to be capable of. So what are the things that hold us back as women? And most importantly, how do we overcome them? With us today to explore these questions is Sally Helgeson, co-author of the new book, How Women Rise: Break the 12 Habits Holding You Back from Your Next Raise, Promotion, or Job. Sally has been described as the world's premier expert on women's leadership by none other than Forbes magazine. She was also the first to seriously study the topic 30 years ago and has continued to do so ever since. Sally is the author of many significant books on women, including The Female Advantage, which has been hailed as the classic work on women's leadership, and The Web of Inclusion, which The Wall Street Journal described as one of the best books on leadership of all time. She is also, of course, one of the most popular conferences for women speakers. Sally, welcome.
Thank you, Lisa. It's wonderful to be here.
Wonderful to have you. Thank you so much. I know you are greatly in demand. You have been for decades, but wow, in the past month alone, I have seen you featured in Forbes, Fast Company, Parade, the Harvard Business Review, the BBC, and lots of other places. What's going on?
What's going on is I think the timing on the book, How Women Rise, which I co-authored with Marshall Goldsmith, has been spectacular. I think women have more confidence in themselves, much more determination. I think there's more support from their organizations and also from many men. And I think there's a greater sense of solidarity among women in terms of their eagerness to support one another. So I think that all those factors, the book came into that environment, and also How Women Rise, which is about the behaviors most likely to get in the way of successful people, is very practical and hands-on. So it's all having an impact.
Well, that's really good news. And, you know, I do want to make the most of our time with you to explore all that. But before we get into it, I'd love to ask you something that I like to ask of most of the people we speak with here, which is, what personally led you to focus your life's work on this topic?
In the 1980s, I was working in corporate communications, mostly doing speech writing, and I was working at a lot of really good companies. But what I became aware of was that the companies that I worked for had no concept of what women could be contributing as leaders. And at the same time, everything that was being written for women in the 1980s had basically the same advice. You're not going to change it, so just adapt to whatever you find as the culture, and basically try to act like the men around you. That's the only path to success. I saw from my experience that women had tremendous things to contribute. I also saw that the environment was changing. I mean, I could not have foreseen the internet and the impact that it would have in the early mid 90s. But I knew that companies were changing and that their cultures needed to evolve in order to be successful. And I felt that women had much of what organizations need. So I really didn't want women to squander the opportunity to have an influence as leaders. So I decided to write a book about what women had to contribute to organizations rather than how they needed to change and adapt. And that was The Female Advantage in 1990. And it was the right message at the right time. It got me started on this path. Companies began reaching out to me and saying, oh, can you work with our women? Can you speak at our conference? So I just stayed with it through good times and bad, because I felt it was something that really needed to be developed and explored. And the time is really positive right now.
Yeah. You know, people seem to feel that it is an incredibly ripe time. And at the same time, a lot of people feel like, ooh, it's, you know, confusing time and maybe a time of some backlash.
Yes.
How do you think about the balance of what's going on?
I think the backlash, and certainly there has been some of that with the Me Too movement, but I think the backlash is much less significant in the big picture than the positive movement forward. I have found, you know, I've been doing this 30 years now. I have been working with women leaders and aspiring women leaders all around the world, you know, from rural India and Pakistan up to, you know, Tromsø, Norway, 500 miles above the Arctic Circle. So I've been doing this for a long time. And what I see now is that, first of all, women have more confidence in their own leadership skills and their ability to make a contribution, and more determination to act on that. I also see, and this is really significant, much more support from their organizations and from the men in their organizations. Not all the men, but there are far more men out there who are supporters of women. When I do programs where there are a lot of men present, my job now is not to convince them that women would make good leaders, but to help them be better champions, allies, and supporters of women. That's what they want. They want specific information on how to do that better, not a rationale. But the third thing, and this is where I think Me Too has been instrumental, is that I see much more solidarity among women, more determination to help support one another. This was missing, certainly in the early 90s. When you do a women's leadership conference at a company, often the senior women wanted nothing to do with it because they didn't want to get tagged somehow as women. They felt it would impact their careers in a negative way and impact their being able to be identified as leaders. So it really has changed. And I think the Me Too has cemented a lot of that solidarity. I've noted how many women have come forward because other women have shared troubling experiences that they've had. And so women who didn't want to speak up have. So I think it has ultimately served the solidarity among women, and that's a very positive trend.
That's real. You are filled with good news today.
You know, I wrote a book called The Female Advantage in 1990, so I'm apparently
right. Well, let's jump ahead to your latest book, which is getting so much attention, How Women Rise, and this great concept of potential. Yes. So you identified 12 habits that you say tend to hold women back, and then 4 ways that we can overcome them. Yeah. So before we jump into those, I'm curious, are these habits or behaviors that only apply to women?
No, these are human habits and behaviors. Some of them apply more to women than to men, but there are certainly, and one of the things I've heard, like one of the behaviors in the book, behavior number 3, is overvaluing expertise. And I've heard from many men, especially those who are in fields like accounting or engineering or the sciences, that they strongly identify with that behavior. But these are the behaviors in both my experience in the 30 years that I've had, and my co-author Marshall Goldsmith's 35 years of being an executive coach. These are the behaviors that are most likely to hold women back from achieving their high potential. So they're human behaviors, but they often have a particular impact on women's careers or on women achieving, as we say, their fullest potential.
Okay, interesting. That's great context. Now, if we had 3 hours, yes, we could perhaps get through all 12, but since we can't, I've pulled out some of my favorites, but I'm also curious if there are some among these habits that you think tend to be the ones that women most need to hear, the more common
ones. Yes, I do. You know, when I do programs in organizations, I always send out a pulse quiz in advance to try to learn which of the behaviors are most resonant for the women who will be at the event that I do. And the ones that come up, the two that come up for general audiences over and over are expecting others to spontaneously notice and value your contributions rather than finding a way to speak up about those and get noticed for them yourself. And that other behavior that I referenced earlier, overvaluing expertise, that is believing that if you become expert enough at what you're doing, that will serve you well and help you get promoted or help you get the job that you want. So you sort of overinvest in becoming expert in whatever it is that you're doing and underinvest in the visibility and the connections that you will need, in fact, to help move you forward, and failing to recognize that basically doing a fabulous job at the job you're doing shows that you are specifically qualified for that job and not necessarily the job going forward. So those are the two I find most generally, but I will also say that I've become aware, working with a book in the months since it was published, that the two behaviors that are probably most toxic at senior levels are the perfectionism and the disease to please. I think I was surprised that the disease to please was so resonant at senior levels, but perfectionism did not surprise me, because in my experience, when I see women who are remarkably qualified not get the senior most positions, it's often because they are perceived of as perfectionists. Mm-hmm. And perfectionism, you know, we like to think that doing a perfect job on something is going to serve us well. But it can also, you know, leadership is kind of having a big picture. And when you identify as a perfectionist or exhibit perfectionistic behaviors, it sort of tags you as a micromanager to some extent, over-focused on the details and not a big picture person. It also creates a lot of stress, both for yourself and for others. As I often point out, I have never in the 30 years I've been doing this heard anyone say, "I work for a perfectionistic boss and I love it." Don't enjoy that experience. So I hear that getting in a lot of women's ways, and it's heartbreaking because these are women who have worked remarkably hard and have many qualities, but they're so invested in getting every detail right that they end up sabotaging themselves at a higher level.
And do you think it's because they've gotten burned at some point for not having gotten every detail right, or their reactions to making mistakes is different? What do you think fuels the frequency of that?
I do think that. I think that women often find that they're judged differently earlier in their careers, that they get rewarded. One of the things, fascinating pieces of research Marshall and I found, was from a large coaching consortium that found that, in fact, and this really supports that men tend to be promoted and rewarded in organizations based on the perception that they're big picture thinkers, based on their connections and based on their visibility, because many senior positions are, of course, outward facing, whereas women tend to be rewarded and promoted based on being precise and correct in what they do. So women are rewarded for being precise and correct. So it's not surprising that they would work on these behaviors. These are behaviors that have served them well throughout their careers, generally. But at the higher level, it doesn't necessarily translate. You know, the model or template for how women rise was really the work Marshall did in his very successful book, What got you here won't get you there. And the premise of that book was that the same behaviors that serve you well early in your career can be problematic as you seek to move higher. And yet you are invested in them because they have helped you earlier in your career. So I thought the template was brilliant. I thought Marshall got some of the behaviors wrong for when it came to women. For example, you know, one of the behaviors was don't always talk about how great you are. Well, that's not much of a problem for most women. Right. Another one, believe it or not, was learn to apologize. Again, not really a problem for women, who many of whom cannot, get through a sentence without saying I'm sorry. But the premise is there. And I think with perfectionism, that is particularly true. And the disease to please as well, because it makes you a likable person. So these are behaviors that really serve you extremely well often early in your career and can lead you to move forward, but are going to be problematic at higher levels.
So it sounds like the art of working with that behavior then is since it is rewarded early on, to try to be as accurate and precise as possible. But as you continue, recognize there's a transformation that has to happen if you want to keep rising.
That's true. But I think the other lesson of that is don't let your focus on being precise and correct make you too averse to risk taking. Mm-hmm. Because when I hear organizations declining to promote a very senior woman who's a perfectionist because of the perfectionism, it's not just the stress they perceive her creating for herself and others as a perfectionist. It's also the fact that they tend to see perfectionists as risk averse. And I know this is, I've talked with some very astute HR leaders who talk about the risk aversion that a lot of women have developed because of being judged on being precise and correct, that doesn't serve them at higher levels, where you want someone, you know, again, big picture thinking involves a certain level of comfort with risk. So what I would say to women is, yes, you know, get the details right, but remember that as you do that, you want to be very careful that you don't develop behaviors that are highly risk averse, because that's not going to serve you well. And it's particularly evident in the reluctance many women have to feel that they are ready for the next position. Well, I haven't gotten this completely down. I'm not perfect at it, so I'm not really ready for the next job. Moving on always involves a bit of risk.
Right, which is a great segue to that other one, which was also one of my favorites, the expecting others to spontaneously notice and reward your contribution. So you're going to burst our bubble and say that doesn't really happen?
It doesn't, especially in today's environment. I mean, it can. Sometimes, you know, it's a wonderful person who's a good noticer. But I would say, especially in today's environment, people are often not co-located. So how are they going to be able to judge, you know, what you're contributing? So often, and people are very, very busy. You know, they're distracted. We're all distracted with our technology, focused on that. And so it's gotten, I think, in organizations even harder to know what other people are contributing. And so it's something that is important for women, I believe, to learn almost from the get-go, from the first day. Don't wait for your performance review. Start keeping lists, even for yourself, of what you accomplished, what you achieved. It can be directly job-related. It can be, you know, I answered this question for a senior person who was looking for some resources or a connection here or there. Keep a list of what you contribute so that you always have that sort of almost in your back pocket, and find a way to feel comfortable talking to people about what you aim to achieve and how you're doing. Often women will pull back from that because they say, oh, you know, I don't want to be perceived of as a self-server. In fact, often when I ask women, you know, who say that they're very poor at, you know, report that they're uncomfortable bringing attention to their own achievements, and I ask why, they'll say, well, if I have to act like that obnoxious creep down the hall to get noticed around here, no, thank you. Well, guess what? There's a middle ground. Mm-hmm. You can find, and you are responsible for finding, a way that you are comfortable sharing what you've achieved. And one of the things that I found that's often helpful for women who are reluctant to do that is to really think about what they're doing as information that can be helpful for other people to know rather than just, you know, it being all about you. It's helpful for other people, especially people in positions of senior leadership, to know what you are doing, to know who you're connected to know what skills you have, to know what successes you've had. So it doesn't mean being a broken record about it, but the expectation that people will notice is often disappointed. And my big concern, I think, is that when it is disappointed, women can start to feel disengaged. They can start to feel like, well, nobody appreciates me around here. You know, maybe I should be in a different position. Maybe I should be in a different company or firm. Maybe I should be working for a different boss. And, you know, that then you start the process of disengagement and of feeling bad. And that's not going to serve you going forward. So I think one of the things that's most important for women is to learn how to do that and to get comfortable doing it and to engage other people, whether it's women or men, as allies to, you know, hey, I think that I've achieved some really positive things on this initiative. I'm determined to find a way to share that. But if you're in a position where you're talking to so-and-so or where you see somebody else, you know, whose job may have been made easier because of what I've done, I really appreciate it if you're comfortable putting in a word for me. So doing that, and it really can pay great dividends in terms of your own engagement as well as in terms of tagging yourself as someone to watch and a real contributor.
That's so helpful. And I love that you said at the outset, you know, to even start a list just for yourself.
Yes, right.
Because that can begin the process, right?
We often focus on what we didn't do right. Yeah. Marshall says that.
Boy, do you know women.
Exactly. Marshall says in 35 years of working with women leaders, he has never once worked with a single woman, Congressional Medal of Honor winner, senator, you know, CEO, who at some point he hasn't had to say, please don't be so hard on yourself. And he says he rarely has to say that with male leaders.
Wow. That is a testament. Well, you have very generously offered to for us to share your list of 12 habits. Yeah. As a downloadable resource on our website, and we will do that at Conferences for Women. So thank you very much for that. I do want to use the time we have left to focus on your four-step
Yes.
process for how we can overcome some of these. And you've alluded to some of that already, but perhaps you could just walk us through that process.
Certainly. And I think this is one of the reasons the book is having the impact it is. I'm finding that organizations are getting in touch with me and saying, we're using this for the entire year for our women's employee resource group. The women are reading the book, and then they're helping one another with, you know, they're doing one behavior a month or something like that. So it's really, I think, part of the reason that it's been successful in that way has been we have such a clear, well-developed template for change based on real research about how human beings change, as well as, you know, our combined, I guess, 65 years of experience in this career. So the first thing is that you want to choose one behavior or even one part of a behavior and focus on that. I have so many women who come up to me and say, oh, I have 9 of these behaviors. I have 6 of them. I don't know where to start. It's overwhelming. it doesn't matter how many you identify with, start with one and make it small. One of the behaviors we have in there, for example, is too much information, too much background, too many details, too much sharing, a lack of ability to be really concise in a presentation. There are a lot of reasons for that. We don't need to go into them now. But one of the things, if somebody identifies that, that's a simple behavior to address. That's easier to address than, you know, being a perfectionist. That's a more complex behavior. But being concise, so you want to start, maybe if that's an issue for you, start there and start in one place. Okay, I am going to get more concise in my presentations at this monthly meeting. So once you have that decision about what you're going to focus on, that's the first step. Then the second step, and this is, I believe, the most important thing in the book, engage other people to help you. Research shows, Marshall and a colleague did an 800,000 person research project on companies around the globe, seeking to find what are the factors that make for successful, long-term, sustained behavioral change. And the number one factor was people who don't do it alone. They work with a coach, they work with a peer coach, or they just get comfortable engaging other people in sort of on-the-spot feedback and coaching. So say it's the concise issue. We're using that as an example. Once you've decided to do that, you're in a monthly meeting. Think of a couple people that you know whose opinion you respect who are also in that meeting. You don't have to be friends with them, and say, hey, you know, I'm really working on trying to get more precise in my presentations in that meeting. Could you watch me, give me any feedback on something you think I could be doing better? Or do you notice any improvement in me becoming more concise? I'd really appreciate it if you would share that with me. You can also go to somebody who is particularly good that you notice is very concise when they make presentations and engage them. Hey, I'm trying to get more concise in my presentations. I notice you are really, really good at it. Is there anything you do in terms of preparation or how you think it through that I could use that would be helpful to me in changing? And what this does, I mean, this is such a powerful practice. It removes, first of all, any kind of shame or embarrassment you have about what you're not great at. It gives you, it's a way of engaging support in your career, even in small ways, and leveraging the relationships you have for your own personal development. So it's positive there. It also advertises the fact that you're changing, which is really important. Often in organizations, we get tagged for behaviors that we've actually outgrown, but people don't notice we've outgrown them because they're busy. So once we start talking about what we're working on and what we're trying to get better at, and engaging people in that effort, then it really, people begin to notice, you know. So, they might have said before, oh, she never speaks up in a meeting. She sits in the back of the room. We've been speaking up for 2 years. They didn't notice. When you talk about, you know, I'm making a commitment to be a much more active participant in meetings, for example, people start to know that. They notice it then. The third and fourth are letting go of, you know, your don't beat yourself up because, you know, you have behaviors to work on. We're all humans. So take that into account and get and lighten up a little bit about it. You know, we're not going to be perfect. We're never going to be perfect. And putting that pressure on ourselves does not serve us ultimately. And then again, recognizing, I mean, every one of these behaviors is a behavior that you cling to because you believe and you have evidence that it may have been useful to you in the past. All these behaviors are also rooted in positive human attributes. The reluctance to claim achievements or expecting others to notice our contributions, those are rooted in a kind of modesty and a sense of proportion. So these are nothing in this book is a bad behavior. It is a behavior that has had usefulness that may not serve you as your circumstances evolve. may not serve you in terms of reaching your full potential. And my belief is that the more women reach their full potential and come into positions of greater authority and influence, the better organizations will be for women and for all people. So that is an aspiration to really look for, to really value.
Well, I am so grateful that you are doing this work, that you noticed what you noticed more than 30 years ago, that, you know, you have brought so much good news today. I think in terms of how much of the positive trend is overshadowing areas of backlash that we see. Yeah. And I'm thrilled that your work is carrying on and you're headed all over the world with this great information, very helpful strategies.
So. Thank you, Lisa. It's been wonderful speaking with you and reaching your terrific audience. It's been a joy to have the opportunity to participate at all the women's conferences this last year.
Well, we're thrilled to have you. So thank you so much for contributing this today. It's a great conversation. And listeners, thank you for joining us. We hope you're enjoying conversations like this one on the Conferences for Women podcast and invite you to tell others about it on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts to help support and further the potential of all working women.